Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on the Gonski Report, yes or no. It's appropriate that we're doing it tonight at the Sydney Institute because it was here at the Sydney Institute about 3 years ago that Julia Gillard, who was then Deputy Prime Minister, announced that there would be an inquiry into education. The names of the people on the inquiry were released later, but the Gonski Report was effectively announced at the Sydney Institute from memory in February 2010. And we've got two fine speakers along tonight. Kevin Donnelly makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, and Jane Kerro makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. Kevin, who will lead first, he'll speak for about 15 minutes, then we go to Jane, and then we go to question and discussion. Dr. Donnelly is a former teacher of 18 years' experience. He's an author and commentator and a frequent contributor to The Australian, and he's most recently the author of Educating Your Child, It's Not Rocket Science, and Janet Grundy's got some copies of that outside. Jane Kerro is a consultant and writer. She's also a lecturer at the University of Western Sydney. She's a novelist and most recently the co-author, along with Chris Bonner, of What Makes a Good School? And Janet Grundy's got some copies of that outside as well for later. So welcome to both our speakers talking on the topic of the Gonski Report, yes or no, Kevin Donnelly. Thank you.
Firstly, thank you for the invitation, Gerard, and thank you, all of you, for coming out tonight. The timing is fortuitous, to say the least, given all the media coverage over the last couple of days. Now, if you've read The Australian today or Quadrant over the last year or two, you'll know that I'm a critic of Gonski, the report, and have been for some years. But before I go into the criticisms, what I'd like to do is just give you a brief outline of Australia's education system. And forgive me if I'm telling you what you already know, but I think it is important to understand that we have a tripartite system of education in Australia. We have Catholic schools, independent schools, and government schools. And it's very important to realise that for most of the last, say, 30, 40 years, apart from the few explosions of debate as we're having at the moment, there's been agreement generally amongst certainly the public that it's acceptable to have that choice. School choice is something in Australia. That wasn't me, by the way. School choice is something that we have in Australia which is taken for granted. If you look at the enrolment figures, government schools enrol 66%, Catholic schools about 20%, independent schools about 14%. Compared to other OECD countries, we have one of the largest enrolments in non-government schools, which I think is obviously a good thing. And especially over the last 10 years, enrolments have grown in non-government schools. Over a 10-year period, enrolments have grown in Catholic and independent schools about 20%. And if you compare that figure of 20% to government schools, the enrolment has only been 1.2. So obviously parents are voting with their feet, as I've written in the past, and I think that's a reasonable thing that there is school choice. One of the myths regarding the debate about school funding is that non-government schools are overfunded compared to government schools. In fact, if you look at state and federal funding at the moment, based on recent figures, government school students receive on average about $14,400 per student. Non-government schools only receive about $7,400. So it's wrong to say that non-government schools are overfunded or that they're receiving more money from government than state schools. And in fact, non-government school parents, of which I was one and Julia's here tonight, we were both teachers. We sent our children to non-government schools because we valued that choice. But non-government school parents actually pay for a system they don't use, state schools, plus they pay school fees. And on some of the latest figures, the saving to government is over $8 billion a year. If every student next week in a Catholic or independent school suddenly had to be enrolled in a state school, governments would have to find an additional $8 billion. That's the cost that parents and schools are actually raising at the local level to pay for that education. I should also say that the current SES model is based on need. So schools like the King's, for example, or Melbourne Grammar, where I'm from Melbourne, would only receive about 13.7% in government funding, as a government school would receive per student. As we know, Julia Gillard, when Education Minister, set up the Gonski Review in 2010. The report recommends a new funding model, what's called the School Resource Standard, and I'm sure you've been reading or listening to the news or watching TV to learn about that. But what is actually the School's Resource Standard? And that's something Jane might be able to help us with, but I haven't been able to find publicly what that actually is and how they've arrived at it. One of the complaints about the process over the last year and a half, when the Gonski report was actually tabled in November, I think it was, 2011, is that it's taken so long to get any details. And in fact, Gonski, the report has been sitting there for over a year, and COAG has to agree on what the model will be Friday this week. And a lot of state premiers argue, if you've been, again, watching the media, they don't know what the model is. But the policy is, or the recommendation is from Gonski, that there's a school resource standard plus additional funding for disadvantage, which I think is a good thing. And in fact, we have that, I would argue, already. We have a system based on need. Students with disability would receive additional funding, and if they go from a government to a non-government school, I would hope the funding would follow the child. And I know there are debates about vouchers, but I think it's only equitable and fair that parents don't have to pay that full cost. One of the interesting things about the release on the weekend is that Julia Gillard talks about an additional $14.5 billion over 6 years, whereas Gonski actually recommended closer to $38 billion. So it's interesting that the funding has been cut way back. Now, the impact of funding, I would argue, is not equitable. And I know a lot of debate has occurred over the last year or two about that question, about equity and about justice in terms of school funding. If we would argue, start from a base or a premise that every child, regardless of school attended, deserves to be financially supported by government, if we say that any new model should be sector blind, as it were, so that you shouldn't be discriminated against if you go to a local Catholic school or an independent school, then I would argue that Gonski has failed, because Gonski actually recommends that whereas wealthy and privileged, I'll use that example, in Melbourne of eastern suburban schools, where Julian and I live, those government schools will receive the full funding in terms of that resource. Non-government schools don't. It's based on parents' capacity to pay. So on one hand, with government schools, if you're a parent sending your child to that school, you get supposedly a free secular education. If you want to choose, for whatever reason, a non-government school, it's going to be based on your capacity to pay. In addition, Jennifer Buckingham, and I'll just quote from her, a non-government school and a government school with the same socio-economic profile would be entitled to different levels of funding. While both school communities have the same anticipated capacity to pay, only non-government schools will have their funding reduced. Now, we can discuss that, and I'm sure there'll be questions, but I'd like to believe that regardless of where you choose to send your child, you should be supported. The Gonski report also recommends that non-government schools must contribute at least 10% of that schooling resource standard from local funds. So if you have a school FATE if you have old boys and girls, women and men who've gone to the school and they contribute through philanthropic support, you have to contribute 10% of that to the school resource standard. Government schools don't have to. And again, I'd argue that's discrimination. Certainly, it's the case from what modelling there has been, and I think it's a bit of a moving feast in terms of what the final modelling will be. But in terms of the modelling about a week or two ago, independent and Catholic school authorities around Australia have said that they are being hard done by, as it were. They're losing money. And it's interesting, Chris Bonner and Jane are both here tonight in an article in the Sydney Morning Herald, and I'll quote them. "No doubt some private schools will become more expensive as their public funding reduces in real terms. Their fees will go up." Now, they would argue that's probably a good thing. I would argue it's not. The other point is that it's not just about funding, and I think this is something that's sort of crept under the radar, as it were. Part of the Gonski report looked at ways of managing schools, about raising standards. And if you look at Julia Gillard, the Prime Minister, her speeches and her media release over the weekend, she talks about the school improvement plan. Every school in Australia, Catholic, independent, government, if you take funding, has to sign up to the school improvement plan. Now, this to me is another flaw, a fundamental flaw, because government and non-government schools will face greater external monitoring and accountability. This National School Improvement Plan, adding science testing to NAPLAN, we already have literacy and numeracy, obviously, at years 3, 5, 7 and 9, but expect that to grow. And I'd argue that schools are already suffering under too much micromanagement and too much accountability. Our daughter Amelia is teaching third year primary, and she spent the last 4 or 5 weeks getting the kids ready for NAPLAN. And I think that happens around Australia. So I'm a great believer, if you read the article in The Australian today, I'll give them a plug, about local control, what the Catholics call subsidiarity. But the reality is, at the moment, it will only get worse if Julia Gillard's recommendations are accepted. Teachers will become bean counters, and education will be reduced to what's measurable or able to be quantified. And as somebody who taught for 18 years and loved poetry, I'm not quite sure how you quantify poetry or music or art, for example. There's also a new bureaucracy being established. So what's happening is that we already, I would argue, have too much bureaucracy in education at the state level. The Commonwealth level has grown over the last 20, 30 years, and that will get worse if Julia Gillard has her way in terms of the Gonski report. As to why the report, I would argue, discriminates, and I know Peter Garrett, the Minister, talks about the Gonski Committee being independent. Two of the members of the Gonski Review, Ken Boston and Carmen Lawrence, are actually on the public record, in print, attacking non-government schools. They both argue that the focus, the priority, must be on government schools, that it's wrong to finance non-government schools, that non-government schools lead to social fragmentation, dislocation, and I'd argue that's obviously wrong. I'd also argue it's wrong to appoint two people to a committee which is supposedly objective and independent when their views are already so well known. Also, some of the research papers commissioned by the Gonski Review obviously had an agenda which they wanted to push. So I would argue the report is biased. One of the examples of that is that SES, or socioeconomic status, the report argues is a key factor shaping outcomes for students. That's wrong. One of the myths, or another one of the myths, is that SES determines successful failure in school. It doesn't. Gary Marks from the ACER puts the influence at 9 to 16%. So if you're trying to identify the characteristics of a strong education system, if you're trying to determine what influences how well children do, then SES is between 9 to 16%. A recent study affecting school completion also concluded that SES, measured by parental education and occupation, quote, is less significant than previously indicated. More important are cultural factors. And as Gary Marx said, he talks about classroom environment, teacher quality, curriculum rigour, parental expectations. There are many other reasons in addition to SES as to why some children do well. Also, the Gonski focuses on disadvantage, but it has a very, what I call, cultural left view. It doesn't talk at all about the fact that the main reason we're going backwards in the PISA international test over the last 5 to 10 years is because our high ability students, our better able students, are doing not as well. So the reality is, one very quick way to raise standards in Australia would be to look at our high ability students and to make sure that they're properly supported. But we never hear about them. I mean, Australia loves sport, we love to win in cricket or rugby, but when it comes to education, mediocrity, this dumbing down approach. How are we going for time?
A couple of minutes.
Okay. I would argue Gonski embraces the cultural left view, as I said. And I'll quote from Gary Marx again, socioeconomic background only partially accounts for school sector differences. Marx puts the impact at 20-30%. The argument for the Australian Education Union and critics is that the only reason non-government schools do well is because they only enrol wealthy students or privileged students. That's not the case. The research shows that when you take into account SES, Catholic and independent schools, still are more able to achieve good results. And international research identifies factors like diversity, competition, autonomy and choice in education. Just finishing off. The Gonski report argues that Australia's education system is characterised by inequity. And again, I'd argue that's not the case. The OECD over the last couple of years have released a couple of reports about Australia. In terms of intergenerational mobility, out of 11 countries, we're at the top of the table in terms of offering what Mark Latham called the ladder of opportunity. A second OECD study, quote, Australia is one of the most socially mobile countries in the OECD, primarily because of health and education, and Catholic schools in particular, and I'll give them a plug, are proven to do as well as Finland in terms of high quality, high equity. It's ironic, and I'll finish with this comment, that Julia Gillard, the Prime Minister, says that we will have our students performing in the top five nations by 2025. Now, it's a silly, stupid thing to say, a bit like Bob Hawke arguing no child will live in poverty. But if she was serious, what she should be doing is making sure that non-government schools get more money and not less, and turning government schools into non-government schools by embracing policies like charter schools or free schools. In England, they're called free schools. Charter schools in America, or vouchers. So if any parent, and say if the figure's 14,400, any parent gets the voucher and they go to whatever school they believe best suits their needs and their child's needs, and the voucher travels with them. And then you do have real choice, diversity and competition. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jan Harrow. Thanks.
Thank you. I want to talk to you first about the great transformative, revolutionary, democratic ideal of secular, free, comprehensive education for all children, regardless of who their parents are. I think one of the things that is forgotten in this debate is that education is not primarily for parents. Education is primarily for children. Children have no choice as to what kind of parents they are born into. The greatest leap into the dark that any of us have ever taken in our lives is to be born. We have no idea what circumstances we will be born into and what sort of parents we may be lucky enough or deeply unfortunate enough to arrive in their lap. The great revolutionary idea that I think probably, well, I know, came along hand in hand with democracy was public education. We've had private education ever since a king could hire a tutor for his son, and it was always his son. And we've had private education ever since wealthier people decided that they would pay for their children's education and created schools for that reason. And we also had it when religions decided to also do it for their members of their community. Public education was the revolution. I think you probably cannot have a properly functioning democracy without a well-supported, well-functioning, strong public education system. Because to give people a vote, you must educate everyone so that they can exercise their vote from an informed perspective. This is the fundamental importance of public education. And the thing to remember about public education is it is open to every child. It does not pick and choose. That doesn't mean that there are some things in public education that personally I'm not all that crazy about, like selective schools, and I pick and choose within the system, and I don't actually like that very much. But the principle of public education is that it takes all comers. Within any kind of education system, you then have to organise it in some way. So there are, of course, local differences. And yes, no public education system has ever been completely 100% no difference between any school equal. But the fact that public education is not necessarily totally equal does not mean you throw your hands up in despair and decide you'll make it even more unequal. That you'll actually widen the gap between kids rather than narrow it. We'll never narrow it completely, but surely if we cannot use our education system to help to close the gap between the children who are lucky in a lottery of birth and the children who are unlucky in a lottery of birth, what on earth are we doing with it? Any tin pot dictatorship can create a highly educated elite. That is easy. It is no challenge. You go around the world, you look at any of the countries you'd hate to think about, they have highly educated elites. What is tough, what is really hard, what marks out a civilised society is a highly educated general population. We have started to lose sight of that in Australia. We are leading the Western world in losing sight of that. And I would challenge you to think that if we, as Kevin seems to think, end up with a completely non-government run system, so a non-public education system, would it be open to all? I don't know quite how it would work. Can we still remain a democracy? Or are we in fact turning ourselves into an oligarchy where we privilege some people to be the leaders and we kind of have proles who'll, you know, do the jobs nobody else wants to do? Because the problem is we talk about school choice as if every parent has equal choice of school. That's not true. What we have done in Australia and what most choice-led processes have done, certainly in parts of America where the charter school thing is happening, is that what we do is we actually give some schools choice over which children they will or won't educate. And that certainly happens here. One of the reasons that many middle-class parents are attracted to private schools is because they know that private schools can get rid of the troublemakers. That is a form of picking and choosing. They can and they say, oh, they'll meet a better class of kids, they'll meet higher achievers. So they are trying to isolate their child from some of the kids that they may or may not approve of. Those kids in our country, thank God, still need to be educated and still deserve to be educated. Gonski took that into account. Now, I'm not going to argue here that what the policy the Gillard government may or may not come up with is going to be the perfect execution of Gonski. I doubt it very much. As Kevin's already pointed out, they've already reduced a lot of the money. One of the reasons they've reduced a lot of the money is that we know we have a lot of children who are really behind the eight ball in terms of the total amount of resources that they have behind their education. And it's no good equating like with like. Some kids in Australia cost $60,000 a year to educate. They're often rural and remote kids. They're often Indigenous kids. They're often kids with really high needs. They don't cost $14,000 a year to educate. They cost $60,000 a year to educate. Let me tell you, the vast majority of those students are in public schools. Once upon a time, we used to have an economy of scale when most kids went to the public education system. Because what we would have is kids in that same system that were relatively inexpensive to educate. Your kids. My kids. They are the kids that are relatively inexpensive. They live close to urban centres, they don't have high needs, they don't have disabilities, they don't bring what we know will affect their educational outcomes, often a lack of cultural capital, through the door when they first arrive. They're inexpensive to educate. Their easy, you know, relative inexpense would help to subsidise the very expensive children that public education also took responsibility for and still takes responsibility for. Public education has lost that economy of scale. There is some new research out by Barbara Preston which shows that now public education, public schools are twice as likely to enrol students from the bottom quarter, that's the lowest 25% of incomes, than they were in 1986. Private schools are twice as likely than they were to enrol kids from high income. Catholic, also there, but medium income. So we now have a three-tiered system of education, with public schools doing what many people call the heavy lifting. What Gonski has recognised is that that is so. And what Gonski and his reviewers, may I also say that David Gonski, in case you didn't know, is the chair of, I think it's Sydney Grammar, and Catherine Greiner, who is also on that committee, is the chair of Loreto. So when we're talking about biased members of the committee, there's some balance there, I think. There were no chairs of public schools. Nevertheless, that Gonski committee looked at schools, saw the schools that were actually doing it toughest, and they started to work out a way of helping those kids. There are three reasons why the Gonski review, I'm not talking about the policy because like everybody else, I'm not sure what it is yet, but the review itself, why it is a sensible thing to do and a once-in-a-lifetime chance for us to help the kids who need our help most. And I don't care about the stats, although the stats are pretty much on my side. I think that that's something a civilised community should just do. The first reason is that the loadings actually follow real evidence-based needs. Now, Christopher Pine and Kevin, apparently, are saying that we already have a system, a funding system, federal government funding system based on need. Trouble is the SES funding system that exists at the moment only applies to students of private schools. This means it's a bit like having a hunger alleviation program which you only offer to the well-fed. It's not, you can't have a needs program that doesn't take into account the schools that educate the vast majority of kids with the most difficult needs. Each state has its own needs-based funding program. But in New South Wales, for example, that usually means the federal government has done some national partnerships work, which has helped a lot of very needy schools get money they need, and they are seeing results, and the atmosphere of those schools is turning around miraculously. But also, most of the time, schools just get $100,000, I think, over the quadrennium, maybe a couple of extra teachers, and they've got to pay it back if it's not all completely spent. None of those rules apply to non-government schools. Now, so the need, the loadings follow actual need, and they're not about what school you go to. So if there is a Catholic school, and there are many that are in a rural, remote area, educating Indigenous kids, they will get almost 90% of their funding, as much as 90% of their funding, from the government, from this scheme. So it is sector blind. It's led by disadvantage. One of the reasons Western Australia is complaining about the amount it's getting is that, according to Barbara Preston's research into where high-income and low-income families live, Western Australia has the highest percentage of high-income families. Tasmania, which it's complaining is getting more money than it, has the highest percentage of low-income families. So it's actually following the need of the children. And that's where we've got to do some hard work. The reason it's very expensive is because Gillard foolishly said no school would lose a dollar. So what we're doing is we're giving kids that are already incredibly well-resourced, doing really well at school, got lots of facilities, everything they need, money for no discernible reason, which is putting up the price of what really could help, which is helping the kids who are way, way, way behind the eight ball. When we send children to school in buildings that are falling down, in classrooms that leak, in places where every kid who shows any sign of doing anything is poached either by the local selective school or the local private school, where parents get to the point where the school becomes so much of a sink school, so residualised, so much taking the only kids that no other school will take, that everyone who can gets out of there, what happens, and we know this from research all over the world, is we compound that disadvantage and the results of the kids in that school start to plummet downwards. We now have new evidence that between 2003 and 2008, in the VCE scores of the 400 schools that do the VCE in Victoria, the results of the high income, schools that have high quartile, high income quartile kids in them, didn't go up. The schools that have the highest percentage of the lowest 25% kids collapsed. Their results, their share of high VCE schools fell by 20%. That is an absolutely disastrous decline. Now, it's not like all their teachers suddenly became terrible. That's just not what's going on. What's going on is we're creating hopeless places. And by that I mean, not hopeless in terms of what's being done by the people who are there, but hopeless in terms of how the children feel about their potential, because we send a message to those kids: we don't care about you, we don't value you, and we don't care what you do. And that's shocking and shameful. So that's the first reason.
You've only got 2 minutes.
The second reason is the Gonski Review treats all Australia's kids as if they live in the same country. This is the first time we will be doing this. All other schemes have been divided on public and private. This one is sector blind. It's about the needs of the students and the schools that enrol them. And even more importantly than that, it's understandable. You can understand the Gonski Review, even me. I can understand it, and I'm an ad writer, what would I know? But I can work it out. There are about 11 people in the country who understand the current way that we fund education. I refer to it as the dark art of education funding. You can make virtually any argument you like about education funding. It's too hard to explain why it's wrong. Good policy is policy that the voters can understand and therefore make an informed decision on. Gonski is clear, it is rational, it is sensible. It isn't perfect. But it may just do something to help the kids who walk through the school gate already on the losing side. Anything which makes their education tougher is a bad idea, and for a civilised country should be rejected. Thank you very much for listening.
Jane. So we come to questions and discussion. There are a lot of people here, and I think people feel strongly about some matters. So if we can keep the comments or the questions brief, and everyone will get a fair go, because that's what you get at the Sydney Institute. Before I go to that, I just should mention that I should say thanks to Clayton Utz for the use of this great facility this evening. And I'd mention again that Jane Carrow's book, What Makes a Good School, and Kevin Donnelly's book, Educating Your Child, are available outside after. Now, Jane had made a few mentions of Kevin, and Kevin hasn't made any of Jane's. So if there's anything you want to respond to, you can do in the first question. I'll just raise the first question, then we go on. Everyone keeps their comments brief. In a column I did about a year ago, I made the point that in a certain street in North Sydney last year, a letter arrived in the, throughout the whole street saying that a couple wanted to move into the street. They wanted to pay $1.5 million, which would now probably be the equivalent of $2 million, for a house because it was a great feeder school, a feeder area to North Sydney demonstration school. So, now on the question of equity, you've got a situation where people who live in certain suburbs, you mentioned the eastern suburbs of Melbourne, I'm talking about North Sydney, where people of what might be called fabulous wealth are getting their children educated for no cost at all and moving into areas and inflating house prices for that reason. So how does that fit in with the equity? You start off, Kevin, then you, Jane, and then we'll go to everyone else. Okay. You come up here. I think it's better to come up here and talk to the back of the room.
The back of the room, right. As a good teacher, I should remember that. But the reality is, even though critics of non-government schools argue that government schools are open to all, They're obviously not. I mean, where I live in Surry Hills in Melbourne, Balwyn High is one of the most popular schools in Melbourne, and you need to spend at least $1.8 million to buy a house, or spend maybe, you know, $800,000 a week for rent to get into the enrolment zone. So the reality is, and I know Jane mentioned selective schools, I think we've got four or five in Victoria. We're a bit reticent in that regard. I think New South Wales has over 20. But selective schools mean that people are obviously chosen on merit. If you go to Bourne High in Melbourne, it's that you've got a big chequebook. So government schools, frankly, are not open to all. And I'm a great believer, as far as practicable, in equality of opportunity, But we don't live in a socialist state where we actually mandate that everybody has to be at the one level of ability or talent or wealth. I mean, I do believe, in fact, that the good thing about a market-driven approach is that, and it gets back to mobility, we do have a very mobile society. Thank you.
Jane? Kevin, stay there. Stay there. Yeah, you move to that side. Jane, yeah.
Okay. You're right. No single school is open to all comers. That would be impossible. But, as I explained, the public school system, when it enrolled most of the kids in Australia, including those from the top... Once upon a time, in 1986, I believe, prior to 1986, according to Barbara Preston's research, public schools and non-government schools enrolled about the same proportion of high-income kids from high-income families. That has now completely changed, so that public schools, despite the few in those wealthy areas, they are no longer enrolling anything like the same number, the same percentage. I've got the figures written down there, but I'm hopeless with figures, so I can't remember what they are. But it's much lower than it was, and it's nowhere near the same as non-government schools. In fact, what we've seen occur is, far from choice actually creating choice for more parents, what we've watched is the choice, the drawing group of kids in non-government schools has actually narrowed. It's become less egalitarian than it once was, and in public schools it's also narrowed, but it's narrowed down and that's narrowed up. So in fact we're dividing our education system by class and by privilege. I'm a great believer in the market. I've worked in advertising for 30 odd years. I'm the high priestess of choice, and I've worked at the coalface, and I'll tell you this, you don't want the market anywhere near schools. And the reason is that markets create winners and losers. That's their point. That's a good thing when you're an adult. Markets also operate really well when you have a highly educated general population, because then you actually get merit. You actually get promotion on merit. But when you actually decide that children will have more opportunities because their parents have the money to pay for schools, then what you do is you destroy the idea of merit and you warp markets. So if you really believe in free markets, you will be a great supporter of public education, as I am, because it's not perfect. But it's the best we've got for creating more or less a level playing field than where we're at now.
David.
My question is really to either of you, although Kevin mentioned that schools get more money, but there's a higher reporting requirement and presumably a higher standard that they're expected to meet. What happens to schools that get the money but then don't meet the standard?
Well,
we're
yet to find out. I mean, different states, different territories at the moment have a variety of ways of coping with schools that are underachieving. As to what Julia Gillard plans to do, I'm not quite sure. In Victoria, I know in Melbourne, for example, schools that consistently lose enrolments, students don't do as well. One or two have closed down and reopened maybe a year later with a new principal, new staff. The principal, and this is the government school I'm thinking of at the moment, had autonomy to select staff and to get rid of staff he didn't want, or she, well, it was a he in this case. So I'm not sure what the new system will be, but I think there has to be some accountability, but it's a matter of how you actually devise that system.
The only schools that you can close down are public schools, because, of course, you can't...
Private schools close down.
Yes, but they're not closed by government.
Well, better still, they're closed by parents.
Well, it doesn't matter, but the only schools that the government can close down are public schools. And we are now seeing situations where some areas are being left with no public school. The only schools they have are fee-charging schools. And we're busing kids in New South Wales at no expense from different suburbs, taking the kids from one locality to another suburb to go to the public school because theirs is closed down, busing those kids into the private school that's operating in that suburb. That costs a lot of money and it helps no one educationally.
Richard.
Australia's a federation and we have competitive states with competitive education systems. I would be most interested to hear your views on whether or not we do away with the 4,000 people in the Commonwealth Education Department and simply give all the money to the states to let the states continue with the sort of competition that is essential in this incredibly intensely competitive world, rather than go to a unitary system that Gonski represents.
So it's a question whether we should go to states or to a unitary system that the Gonski report recommends.
Well, it's true the Commonwealth government doesn't actually run any schools. I mean, the state governments do. I don't see that as likely to happen anytime soon. I worry about this whole emphasis on competition for very young children. I think there was a very wise saying which said, people who are most in favour of any competition are those most likely to win it. And I think that's true. I think that those of us who are high achievers are very keen on competition because, after all, we did well in it. But I know that from the teachers I know well who work with kids who have been born to parents who are not winners in that competition and therefore start out already behind the eight ball, that the whole thing they try to do is help those kids to get to a point where, when they're adults, they can compete. I am not at all convinced, and there's very little evidence to show that it works, that a raw competitive system of states and schools does anything but advantage those who are already born privileged.
Kevin, you want to make a brief
comment? Just quickly, some research by Carolyn Hoxby in America looks at disadvantaged communities, ghetto schools, in many of the cities like Chicago. And her expression is that competition and choice actually is a tide that will lift all boats. That schools, government and non-government, in that sense, do well. And also, I have written in many places about my fear of national Canberra. All roads lead to Canberra. I mean, we have a national curriculum, national testing, national teacher registration, national teacher certification, national leadership training. The reality is, under our constitution, the states control school education, and I'm a great believer in innovation and change in education. And if you have a one-size-fits-all approach where all roads lead to Canberra, where you move away from what the Catholics call subsidiarity, where the decisions are made by those most affected who know what is going on, then I think it's a recipe for disaster.
Question.
I'm a former teacher, and I've taught everywhere from Brunswick High to Loretto Kirribilli. In my view, I think the parents are very important in education, so this is a question for both of you. To what extent is the problem for public education that it has, for too long, let down the parents? And the parents have, as Kevin said, voted with their feet. As someone who taught in Catholic schools, taught in public schools, taught in what we might call independent schools, I would say the parents are some of the most valuable contributors to a child's education. And my fear for this whole program is that it all keeps talking about Canberra, bureaucrats. There's no sense of community around the school. How can we make that important for public education?
Before I lead up with Jane, before I do, I think we should clarify, because there are different terminology in different states. So we're talking about government schools, which are called public schools in Victoria, private schools in New South Wales. So let's talk about government schools and non-government schools. Okay. Jane, and then...
I've never seen community better than around public schools, to be honest. In most areas, particularly the public primary school, is where people make friends, where they create their... I mean, in fact, I have friends in the audience here who I met at the local public school when their children went to school with my children. So I wouldn't be too frightened about the communities around public schools. I think they're really strong and they absolutely exist. Of course, parents are unbelievably vital. There is research to show that, in fact, what happens inside schools only affects 40% of the eventual educational outcome of the child. 60% of what affects the educational outcome of the child happens outside of school and is mostly led by parents. That's the basis of my whole argument, that in fact you can't pick your parents, and we can't say to kids who are born to perhaps parents, I don't want to stigmatise them, but parents who with less money, who can't afford to pay fees, are only have less money because they prove less able to navigate their way through society than some other kids' parents. Well, they're not necessarily going to be able to lift their child up on their own, are they? That's the problem. That's how you entrench privilege and underprivilege. I think parents are incredibly important. And in every school I know of, from the very poorest to the very richest, parents are involved. I don't think we should stigmatise poor parents as not being involved in their kids' schools. They are, but they haven't got the resources, the education themselves, or the money, or the clout, or the confidence to do as well as, say, the people in this room can.
Kevin, you want a brief response?
Well, that's the reason I wrote the book, Educating Your Child. It is for parents, and mainly my nieces, who are all busy populating. So parents are critically important. There was an OECD report, I think, last year, that looked at the number of books in the home, and if parents read to their children from a very early age, then that's a crucial indicator of success. But I would like to believe we don't just justify what we say on hearsay or anecdotal evidence. There is a lot of research in Canada, in America and Australia, and I don't want to disparage government schools. I taught in one. I went to two government schools. But there's a lot of research that shows, contrary to what Barry McGaugh says, who's head of our curriculum authority, ACARA, non-government schools don't contribute to social dislocation or fragmentation. Supposedly they do because they're elitist. All the research in Canada and America and Australia shows that Catholic schools in particular are very good at consolidating social capital, those aspects like reciprocity, civility, community engagement, probably because a lot of the parents and the teachers and the kids meet en masse on Sunday and the kids are going to the local parish primary school. But we need to engage parents, that's obvious, and we need to ensure that parents are supported. But governments can't control everything. As I said, we're not a socialist state.
Okay, there's a question here.
My question is, first I think we're talking about two issues. One is the government school or non-government school. Another question is the competition performance of schools. So they are separate. And my question is, have anybody done, or is there any study about international benchmarking for a nation of students' literacy, numeracy, and a country's productivity against percentage of government school? I don't know the answer, but I observe, at least for Germany, there's only government school. It's all free, and they probably have one of the best numeracy and the literacy and the productivity in a way for the Western countries.
Okay, Kevin?
There's a good deal of research internationally about what are effective schools and the characteristics of stronger performing education systems. And I've been looking at that for the last 20 years, completed two or three benchmarking projects for state and federal governments. The reality is there's no silver bullet, as the Americans would say, and I think that's one of the problems we have at the moment, that we think that if we throw more money at this, if we get better qualified teachers, if we somehow reshape the curriculum, it's a very difficult, complex issue as to why some schools in some countries do better than others. In Finland, for example, one of the top performing countries in the world, they don't have what I would call cultural left education teacher unions. Teachers actually teach from the front of the room. They have a very traditional orthodoxy in terms of their pedagogy. Now, does that mean in Australia, if we want to be as good as Finland, that we ban unions and we all stand at the front and lecture like I am now? I'm not sure. Shanghai appeal, you know, achieves excellent results, but they're often one-child families, they're very middle-class professional families, they have Saturday tutorials, as you know, and the kids with their tiger mums are pressured. Do we want to import that here? I'm not sure. So it's very difficult to say there are one or two answers. Unfortunately, politicians, and I know a few, often look for the short-term political expediency in terms of a 20-second sound grab. And Gillard, if you like, her belief that we're going to be the top five, our kids will be in the top five nations by 2025 is just an example of that.
Quick response, Jane.
Finland also actually makes equity the central plank of its education system. It didn't concentrate on literacy and numeracy, and it didn't concentrate on academic achievement. It concentrated on equity. It began in the 1980s after it introduced quotas for women in all areas of government committees and decision-making areas, and it is now Pasi Sahlberg gives credit to women because he said they put student well-being at the centre of the education system, and that's when results went up.
Now we're going to finish right on time at 7, so I'm doing as much as I can. There's a question here. No, okay, don't need to stand up. Yeah.
Please. The question is about government schools. Jane, you seem to be referring to them as being for the underprivileged. Many of our government schools are in well-to-do areas, Pymble, Killara, St Ives. How do you then cope with that situation with people who could afford to pay fees but choose not to?
Quick response, Jane.
Well, it's very easy. If you believe in choice, I'm assuming you actually believe in choice and not just choice of parents who choose the schools you think they should, because that's a funny kind of choice. I've often argued, how does it increase any parent's choice to run down the public schools and remove them from most people's choice? The point about public schools is anyone can send their children there if they want to. The fact that you choose not to is entirely up to you and your right to do so. But should at any time your child no longer be welcome at that non-government school, maybe you lose your job and you can't afford to pay the fees anymore. Maybe they misbehave. Who knows? Whatever the reason is. They can go back to their local public school any day, and that school has to accept them. It has no right in law not to accept them if they're of compulsory school age. The reverse is not true. So to equate non-government and government schools in terms of whether you pay fees or don't pay fees or can afford or don't afford is not the point. The point is these schools are actually about educating all children regardless of who their parents are, and they will take your kid, even if they're a little bugger and mucked up so much they got kicked out.
Okay, very quick response, then we're going down the back, yeah?
If, as Jane said, the focus should be on the child or the individual pupil or student, then that's a great argument for vouchers, because then, as a parent, you have a voucher for, say, $17,000, and that would follow the child wherever the child went, whether it was Catholic, independent, or government.
Down the back.
Can I just support the speakers in regard to the importance of parents' education? I'm a teacher of 30 years' experience in government schools, educated in Catholic schools, happily. And what I've noticed is that it's parental support plus the ability of students is one of the biggest factors in achievement. And what is happening now is, in New South Wales, the ATAR score in the teaching is very low, and I think there are two factors involved in that. I'm interested in what your views on that. One is teacher salaries, which are on the low side. And second of all, there's a lot of schools out there which have become blackboard jungles. And I don't think throwing money at them like the VER did is going to solve that problem.
Just very quickly, a lot of the surveys done by teacher unions looking at teachers, why beginning teachers in particular leave after 4 or 5 years, up to 30-40% of beginning teachers say that they might not be in the profession. Part of it, and it's the elephant in the room, part of it is misbehaviour, classroom discipline. Children coming to school, and this is where it is different to places like Singapore or Hong Kong or Shanghai, children coming to school not ready to be responsible, to respect authority, to respect adults, and to work together in a civil way. So classroom behaviour is a real issue. The other one is the fact that my daughter, for example, she was on 3 6-month contracts. So this idea of short-term contracts for teachers is appalling, because many of them can't get job security, they can't get a home loan or a car loan because they don't have that security. So that's another issue. But I get back, as you did, to parenting. Gary Marks, all his research shows, and it's supported by overseas, it's about home environment, student motivation, and that really has to start in the home.
Jane, you want a quick response?
Yes, I think that when teachers leave, yes, a lot of it is that we are increasingly making some classrooms much harder places to be than other classrooms. But that's exactly what you'd expect to happen if you start to differentiate your school systems according to privilege and underprivilege. As you concentrate kids from the bottom quartile in the same classrooms, oddly enough, the behaviour in those classrooms is really hard work, because they are bringing through the door really high levels of Diane Ravitch says it, the great campaigner for public education in America. It's not teacher quality, it's not autonomy, it's none of those things, it's poverty. The problem with a lot of schools is that they're dealing with the social issues that our society doesn't want to look at. And they're the last places that have to, and have to struggle them day on day, and we're throwing 22 and 23-year-old kids into those classrooms with very little support, particularly in disadvantaged schools with little money, and saying to them, get on with it. It's not entirely surprising that a lot of them get out of it.
Now we're getting towards the end. This question is going to be quick. Yep.
I just wanted to say one thing and ask one question. Yeah. Quickly, you cannot discount SES. It is most important in early childhood, and that's one of the things that drives the later events. So if you talk about schools that of certain kinds that are producing socially responsible persons, that relates to early childhood and the parents' SES.
Okay, we got.
I want to know what evidence you had, Mr. Donnelly, as to the learning outcomes of children in the scheme which you are proposing. I don't think you mentioned children more than once.
You've asked the question. Okay, answer. Yeah.
Just very quickly, the research that I quoted Gary Marx says that SES, I think it was about 6 to 18%, 14% as a factor. I know there's an LSAE, I don't want to get too technical, project that looked at that as well. I'll just finish by saying I grew up in Broadmeadows Housing Commission, alcoholic parents, a lot of poverty, a lot of distress, a lot of violence. Guess what? We all went to school, we sat in rows, we listened to the teacher, we did our homework, we cleaned our shoes every morning, we did what we were told, and many of us went to university. And I think that was wonderful. One of the problems now is the pedagogy, the style of teaching, and really it's not as simple as saying that by throwing more money at the problem, it'll remedy it.
A quick response from Jane, then we go to our last question. Yep.
The only thing I'd like to say is I always don't like that phrase about throwing more money at the problem. It's always said by people or by systems of schools that have an awful lot of it. If money is not helpful, I'd just like to ask the question, why do we have some schools where kids are resourced at over 25 times the resources of a kid in an average public school? Why are we doing that if money doesn't help? And where's the return on our public investment in those schools?
Okay, now a lot of people here, we couldn't do everything, so we've got a final question there, and you can make,
I was the principal of New Dependent School in the inner west of Sydney for 21 years, and we took lots of boys whose principal at the state school would like to move them out, and I reckon we had about a 70% success rate, and some of them took to our school like a fish to water, and they had no problem. And others we had problems with, persevered with right through. Let's say about 20% went back to the school from which they come from.
So I think the microphone collapsed at one stage there, but the suggestion was that this inner western private school was taking people who the government schools wouldn't take. So I think we can make, we'll respond to that question and then make some just some final responses. So who went first? So you can go second. So we'll finish up with Jane and then we'll finish up with Kevin. Answering that question, anything else you want to say?
Terrific that you did that, but it was your choice. The point for the public schools is, and they may have done a deal with you, so you take those kids and maybe you did a bit of a swap, because that can happen, but the point is the public school by law has to accept the child in their local area. So if people make arrangements, that's fine, but actually public schools remain the only schools that have to take the children that in the end are the toughest, hardest, most difficult to teach, and we're seeing that affect their results.
Final comment, Kevin.
Just very quickly, postcode is not destiny. I mean, demography is not destiny. And I think that's been proven.
That's right. Hang on. Can we just let the speaker finish, because this is the final comment.
And I'll give one example. There was a review of literacy by Ken Rowe, God bless him, who died tragically a couple of years ago, that looked at literacy around Australia. And one of the highest performing primary schools was in West Heidelberg. If you don't know Melbourne, it's a migrant, multicultural, housing commission, poverty, a lot of violence. He got some of the highest results in NAPLAN testing with literacy, and he did it because he expected them to do well. He had very committed and qualified teachers, and they actually taught a more traditional approach, phonics and phonemic awareness, instead of whole language. And this is the whole other area we haven't even looked at. If you really want to improve standards, close down the schools of education.
Now, I know a lot of people here, we couldn't get around to everyone. We've done our best. We've given both our speakers a fair go, and everyone has behaved themselves here tonight, or nearly everyone, so we've done very well. So there are copies of Chris Bonner and Jane Carrow's book, What Makes a Good School, and Kevin Donnelly's book, Educating Your Child Outside. Both Kevin and Jane are very fine advocates of their positions.
I've seen that in the past, we've seen it here tonight. We'll publish their papers in the longer form in the Sydney papers online. The talks are up on the podcast at the Institute tomorrow. ABC Big Ideas, as here as is Sky News Channel 648. So we've had a very comprehensive discussion of a very important issue. I'm not going to make any comment about what I've heard except to say thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
And thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
Thank you, thank you, everybody. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.